From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, 100 years of biology and the biomedical sciences. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are Seymour Cohen of the State University of New York at Stony Brook and James Ebert, president of the Carnegie Institution in Washington, D.C. Where are the origins of biomedical scholarship and practice in the United States? How did the biomedical sciences in America develop and flourish? Some answers and insights on this edition of Soundings. According to Seymour Cohen and James Ebert, the 1980s mark a series of centennials for American biomedical science and practice at major research institutions, such as the University of Chicago and the Johns Hopkins University. Also at or near centennial anniversaries in the mid-1980s are the Carnegie Institution, the Rockefeller Institute, the Smithsonian Institution, the National Institutes of Health, and the Woods Hole Marine Biological Laboratory. Seymour Cohen, you're talking about some of these centennials, scientific, that are upon us. Pick one or two of these anniversaries, and tell me why you think they're important. You mentioned Woods Hole. You mentioned Johns Hopkins University. We have the president of the Carnegie Institution sitting right here at the table.
Well, Jim has one coming up in about 5 or 6 years, I guess, the foundation of the Carnegie Institution. Mm-hmm. And what happened about 100 years ago was a pulling together of resources and people who had been trained in a variety of biological disciplines, and the intense desire to emulate and surpass, perhaps, their European counterparts, who had developed a very significant body of scientific knowledge. And all this came together in the 80s. Now, there were a number of practical aspects to this. For one thing, the science which these biologists had learned was that new advances in microbiology, for example, which now could extend to hygienic practice and the utilization of these practices by microbiology by American scientists to facilitate the medical enterprise in this country. So that all of this came together at about the 1880s, mm-hmm. and a lot of things then happened. The institutions jumped off, the graduate training jumped off, and the scientists now became very much more productive with the acquisition of new students, new equipment, new institutions, mm-hmm. so that we can really talk about 1880 or so as the beginning of modern biological science. Mm-hmm.
James Ebert from the Carnegie Institution, can you name some people and some events that in your mind that you associate with the rise of the scientific enterprise in this country? Certainly Mr. Carnegie himself would be one of them.
Well, I suppose since my own roots are at Johns Hopkins, uh-huh. perhaps the Johns Hopkins names come forcibly to mind, and there I think of Daniel Coit Gilman, who was the founding president of both Johns Hopkins and later Carnegie Institution of Washington. Hmm. Gilman was an extraordinary figure, and I suppose his perception of the university was what began to shape graduate education in the United States. To Gilman, he saw the university as a whole, as a laboratory. And the Johns Hopkins led the way in graduate education, I suppose, Seymour, along with the University of Chicago at roughly the same time, mm-hmm. because in both universities, they saw experiment as the order of the day.
Seymour Cohen.
Well, Chicago took off, as Jim said, just about the same time, and not only contributed, but began to compete very seriously with Hopkins in 1892, when it changed its face from that of a minor Baptist college in Chicago to a major graduate institution, it began to look around for the major biologists of the time and to attempt to attract them to Chicago, and indeed did attract a group from Clark University, which had been founded a bit earlier and was having some management problems, and began to acquire then skilled people who were, in addition, very important in the major biological enterprises of the time. For example, one of them, the head of biology at Chicago, who became head at Chicago, was also the director of the Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole, which he had, in effect, founded with the aid of a small group of colleagues, many of whom had been from Hopkins. So that the entire enterprise began to proliferate from this this small center of a few very intense, very capable, and really sharp individuals who knew that there was money out there and that this could be applied to the growth of these institutions.
James Ebert.
I think that, too, the Hopkins experience demonstrates very sharply how the leaders in American education looked to Europe in fashioning their universities. Gilman, for example, in determining the course of biology at Johns Hopkins, looked immediately to England and to Huxley. And indeed, it was a recommendation by Huxley which led to the presence on the Hopkins campus of the first chairman of biology, Martin, who in turn shaped then the future of biology at Johns Hopkins. So one sees the interplay between Europe and America very effectively in the Hopkins example.
Jim Ebert from the Carnegie Institution, is American science the best in the world? Is it possible to talk in grandiose terms like that? We're discussing 100 years of biology, the biomedical enterprise in the United States.
I think most biologists would feel uneasy in having that question put to them. I think in the first place, one cannot talk about American science being best across the board.
Is it pointless, for example, to put the adjective American or Russian or to put any adjective in front of the word science?
I think we would prefer not to put such adjectives. I think there is naturally a kind of national pride in all of us. Nonetheless, I think if one looks at many of the developed countries of the world, one finds one or another field of science in which that nation does extraordinarily well.
How, Seymour, let me ask you to follow that up. We're talking about 100 years of biology in the United States. What about, you've been discussing Johns Hopkins University, for example. What about the general educational structure in this country? I hear almost periodically you'll hear stories about how American kids, 1 in 20 are taking courses in science. Kids in other countries, it's 18 out of 20, that sort of thing. Does that kind of statistic come home to you? How do you reflect on what the state of science education in this country?
I'd like to continue just a bit, because I do think it relates to the question you're asking. I'd like to continue with one of the things that Jim was saying. The attachment of the term American or British or European or something does carry a significant connotation, because during this past century, the Europeans were in effect organizing the destruction of their civilization in many ways and the destruction of their science. And it relates to your question in the sense that they were taking their young people and putting them in the army, and very large numbers of them were being killed in World War I. And we were very fortunate in having an ocean separating us and being drawn into those wars very late, and actually having a loss due to our actual involvement as a relatively minor component of our growth process. So that during the period from 1880 to 1980, the Europeans, in many senses and at many times, really wrecked the development of their educational systems and their science. and changed their cultures, whereas we had this perspective which was developed around the notion of being separate, of having untold resources, and just growth. It's only very new that we're beginning to think of the fact that we no longer perhaps have as many resources as we would like.
Mm-hmm. Seymour Cohen's remarks open up an interesting door here. Seymour Cohen from the State University of New York and James Ebert from the Carnegie Institution. Again, in generalities, how would you characterize the way scientists talk about their social responsibility, the kinds of issues that Seymour has been reflecting on? Earlier in our conversation, Jim Ebert talked about scientists' reluctance to talk in terms of progress, quote-unquote. And yet, you can't avoid the fact that you are part of a public enterprise. Tell me about this.
Well, I think that scientists, by and large, are increasingly aware of their larger responsibilities mm-hmm. in the world. But to this day, only a relatively small fraction choose to be embroiled in the public issues on a day-to-day basis. I think the question that you posed just a few moments ago about the state of education in the sciences in the nation is a very good example of that very point. As I see it, the problem of education in the sciences breaks down into two issues. The one, the training of future scientists. And there, I think many will agree that we do not, at least at the moment, sense a serious problem. The small fraction of the brightest young minds seem still to be drawn to the sciences. On the other hand, the state of science education for the larger population of the nation, I think, is in a serious state of disarray. Mm-hmm. I think it's at this point that your question, suggestion that perhaps only a very small fraction of American students become trained in the sciences comes home to us.
Is that the sort of thing, Seymour Cohen, that scientists talk about amongst themselves? Are they concerned, for instance, that there may be misapprehensions, misconceptions about science and science as an enterprise in the populace?
They're too busy to really discuss such problems.
Really,
the specialization that has gone along with professionalization of the scientific activity has increased the tempo of their own work, the demands upon them in teaching, applying for funds, the educational jobs they've got in lecturing and instructing. And as a result, it's amazing that any scientist is able to function at all. Mm-hmm. The irreversibility of science means also that you drop all the garbage that you've got that you've accumulated in terms of wrong ideas and wrong notions, and these are in the past. Nobody bothers to discuss how they arise. This is one of the reasons why scientists don't pay much attention to history generally. In other words, that you just acquire new knowledge and you're at the frontier pointing towards the next step and not towards the past. Uh-huh. And as a result, you don't think about a lot of things that bear upon your current existence.
But isn't this a problem? Let me put this to you, Jim Ebert. Seymour Cohen is telling me that scientists are, in effect, ahistorical. Don't they need to be part of the social fabric?
They do, and I think this single-mindedness does the scientific community a disservice. Uh-huh. I think as scientists, we tend to respond to the needs of the larger society only when we're in crisis. Uh-huh. Only after the Rifkins of the world and others begin to raise the bugaboo of cloning experiments, mm-hmm. of human cloning. Only after concerns are raised about the influence on the environment of recombinant gene technology. Only after these concerns have reached a point of great public outcry do the scientists really now engage themselves in conversation with the larger mm-hmm. public, and where we somehow be able to engage in these conversations much earlier at the roots of the problem, we'd be far better off.
Mm-hmm. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a conversation about 100 years of biology and the biomedical sciences in the United States. My guests are Seymour Cohen of the State University of New York at Stony Brook and James Ebert, president of the Carnegie Institution in Washington, D.C. According to Seymour Cohen and James Ebert, the mid-1980s marked the centennials of several noteworthy biological research enterprises in America, including the National Institutes of Health, the Woods Hole Marine Biological Laboratory, the Smithsonian Institution, and the Carnegie Institution. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Seymour Cohen worked on a forthcoming biography of Thomas Cooper, one of the leading founding figures in American science. James Ebert from the Carnegie Institution and Seymour Cohen from the State University of New York. Our topic is 100 years of biology in the United States. Let me invite each of you to pick one or two issues in your in the disciplines of greatest interest to you, and discuss such an issue in terms of what its popular impact, its popular importance. We have been talking about popular culture. We've talked about politics and ideology. Are there issues in biology, biomedicine, that you think deserve greater attention? Why are they important to you? Seymour?
I'd like Jim to start first so I can get my thoughts together.
Okay. Jim, Ebert.
Let me focus not on past, but on the future.
Okay.
Which, of course, as we've just remarked, does arise out of the past. It's, again, an illustration of the importance of history. The large question before us now, in the basic sense, in my own field, is the origin of form. That is, we're beginning to understand how the proteins that make up, say, a muscle or the retina of the eye, how these proteins are synthesized under the control of genes. And yet, at this moment, now in 1986, we have barely scratched the surface of knowing how a hand becomes a hand, how a foot becomes a foot.
Is this what's called morphology? Help me with the terms
here. This would be called morphogenesis, the origin of form. But going beyond that, there are some very practical implications. If you look at lower organisms, salamanders, for example, they can regenerate a hand or a foot or a part of an eye. One can experimentally, and discoveries going back two decades or more, change the pattern of development in a frog, which ordinarily cannot regenerate a limb, and cause it to regenerate a limb. And yet these advances are not yet available in the mammals from, say, the mouse or man. I think these problems loom up very large in the next decade or two as among those that I feel most anxious to see solutions.
Let me, Jim Ebert, let me be a little impertinent. So what? Why is this important to just Americans in general? Is it in terms of what, a sort of filter down and fallout kind of thing? Or are you talking about what we call scientific breakthroughs when you read about things like this in the newspapers?
Well, I think, of course, to me, since my roots are in science, although I haven't done an experiment for some years, to me, I think the pure joy of understanding the origin of form is paramount. But there are these enormous practical implications.
Mm-hmm.
If you consider that 1 in 16 babies born in the United States are born with defects of form.
Uh-huh.
If you consider the vast waste resulting from auto accidents and other kinds of accidents, in paraplegia, in the loss of limb, I think there are important practical implications
mm-hmm.
that will follow very rapidly upon the so-called breakthroughs in basic science.
I see. Seymour Cohen?
We've only been in this business, if you must call this acquisition of knowledge activity a business, for a century or so. And this is almost the kind of time in which any one of us at the present time can go back. That is, if we've had 50 years in the activity, we would have had a teacher just when we started who could also go back 50 years, so that we might almost go back to the very beginning of the American enterprise in biology and biomedical science. And among the very first of these, coming to America from Germany and Italy, was a man named Jacques Loeb, who thought that the time was ripe to really think about controlling biological form. Some of his first work in Naples when he was there was on regeneration in marine organisms, and he thought this would be a very good thing to work on, and began to study this in marine organisms at the Marine Biological Lab at Woods Hole, and from this developed the very first experiments on artificial parthenogenesis, which is a subject of great potential concern in all kinds of social phenomena. We really haven't gotten there, but we see the path to get there, how one might control. And it's only within the last couple of decades that we've acquired enough information and knowledge in genetics and microbiology and in biochemistry so that the integration of all of these permits us to think about how we might approach the problem of the control of form. And although this subject was too difficult for people working in the 1880s and up to 1930 and 1950, right now there's a rebirth of interest in this field, so that after a considerable period, the pulling together of several apparently disparate disciplines now permits a new look, a new possibility of understanding the mechanism of the development of form, and with this kind of knowledge might come the kind of information that Loeb was hoping for, mm-hmm. to permit us to control form. Mm-hmm. So that in the period of, let's say, the 50s through the beginning of the 20th century, there was an enormous increase in scientific organizations relating to the treatment of disease and the acquisition of knowledge, improvement in medical schools, and so forth and so on. And all that has led to a vast amount of precise information which the physician uses and which doesn't give him much time to think about anything else.
Jim Ebert?
Well, I think, though, specialization is a way of life, and it's absolutely necessary for advance. But it does heighten the urgency, coming back to our earlier conversation, that we need more individuals with the great capacity for synthesis, mm-hmm. for exposition to the larger public. And I think that this is one of the points at which the scientific community does less well than it should. Mm-hmm. There are too few. To take just one example, E.O. Wilson's the great figure in sociobiology, who writes so magnificently in Evolution, recently addressing the crisis in biological diversity. One needs these kinds of ideas made available to the larger public. Mm-hmm. And to the students in our schools.
Mm-hmm. Jim Ebert, you may have answered my question here, but let me put it to you anyway. You and Seymour Cohen from the State University of New York, we've been talking about 100 years of biology in the United States. Let's conclude our discussion. What would you tell a general audience as you look at the aspects of biology and biomedical science that you're most concerned with? What do you think needs to be more widely known about what you do and the aims that you have as scientists? Seymour, may I begin with you?
I think almost any laboratory scientist today knows that information, new discovery, is coming at a pace that is simply phenomenal, that our vistas for the future are that we're transforming the state of knowledge, that biological information, the capacity to control, the capacity to innovate, is moving at an enormous clip, and that this presents not only enormous opportunities but potential difficulties of various kinds, which are out of pace with the development of society as a whole. The public must become aware of where the science is going, and the biological science isn't that complicated. It isn't that difficult. It's the point of intersection with the society that is going to become the major problem.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking here about journalism? Are you talking about what specifically, what means do you have in mind?
Oh, Jim was talking about, perhaps he was talking about medical practice and controlling form.
Okay.
That's one thing. I mean, are we willing to permit these kinds of changes? We foresee the capacity to control genetic determinants.
Well, let me ask you to pause on this, Seymour. Who should make these decisions? Should it be what, medical administrators? Should it be the scientists themselves? Should it be ordinary, everyday citizens who can express opinions about the nature and the direction of the scientific enterprise? Jim Abert?
It should be an informed public. Mm-hmm. I would say I don't like the phrase ordinary citizen, mm-hmm. in the sense that too often it refers to a citizen who isn't informed. I think it's the responsibility of the scientific community coupled with the body politic to assure in the decades ahead that we have an informed citizenry. At that point, then, what one needs is an interaction between the informed citizenry and the scientific community. And I think with this kind of an interaction, then I think wise decisions can be made.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about 100 years of biology and the biomedical sciences in America. My guests were Seymour Cohen of the State University of New York at Stony Brook and James Ebert, president of the Carnegie Institution in Washington, D.C. For a cassette copy of Soundings on 100 Years of Biology in America, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about the historical origins of political and social unrest in Northern Ireland. The Soundings panelists will be James Donnelly of the University of Wisconsin and Carl Theodore Hoppen of the University of Hull. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond and his guests this week for a conversation about 100 years of the biomedical sciences in the United States. Some answers and insights from Seymour Cohen of the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and James Ebert, president of the Carnegie Institution in Washington, D.C. 100 Years of Biology and the Biomedical Sciences in America. This week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station,